Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Negligence series, the Dylan Redwine story, brought to you by me, Eric Carter-Londine, the host and producer of True Consequences. Today is a very special day. By now, you've listened to, I think, about 11 episodes of the Dylan Redwine story, so you should have a really good idea of what has been happening leading up to the trial. The last episode, we talked about the indictment with a grand jury and how that started to unfold through the judicial process. As you know, the case took a long time to get through the court system. So I want to take a minute to just appreciate the amount of information that you've absorbed. I want you to just think back to the very beginning, and we're going to revisit a lot of these topics. I'm joined today by somebody very special. Bob Mata, who is the host of the Defense Diaries podcast, which if you're not listening to it, you absolutely need to. It is a must listen. Bob received one of the strangest gifts on his 21st birthday that anybody could ever receive from his father. And it was a box of cassette tapes that were recordings of John Wayne Gacy. And Bob and his team dug into those and learned a lot. And you'd be surprised what he found out. So if you're not listening, please go listen to Bob. And while you're there, give him a 5-star review because he deserves it. I need to thank a couple of people. So I need to thank Alexandria so much for being my latest patron. Thank you. It means the world to me. You're helping me keep this crazy show going, and I'm so grateful for you. I also need to thank my co-producer, Jackie Moranti, who's helped me write a good number of episodes for this season and has helped produce them as well. And I would be remiss if I didn't thank JT Hosack for his voiceover work, as well as CJ from Beyond the Rainbow and Lane from Suffer the Little Children. With that, I'm Eric Carter-Londine, and this is True Consequences, Negligence, the Dylan Redwine Story. Welcome back to True Consequences. I'm your host, Eric Carter-Londine, and I am joined by the amazing, incredible, stupendous, wonderful Bob Mata. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Eric. Thanks for having me, man. I'm really excited to join you.
I'm very, very excited to have you here, and I was beside myself when you agreed to join for this conversation. When I told my co-producer, she got very excited to know that we would have somebody with experience in litigation, specifically in these types of trials. So welcome. But before we get into all of that, I want you to talk about your show, talk about yourself, talk about anything you want to talk about before we jump into Dylan's case.
All right. And then just remember, just cut me off because I can ramble, man.
You got it.
And thank you for the introduction. It was wonderful. My name is Bob Mata. I am a recovering criminal defense attorney of about 20 years. Decided to become a podcaster probably about a year ago. I'd been tinkering with the idea for a couple of years. As you talked about those tapes that I got from my dad, I had been sitting on them for 30 years and wasn't exactly sure what to do with them. And I had gone through a couple of protracted and negotiations, you'd call them, with both Netflix and A&E to license the sound of those tapes. And ultimately, I couldn't get a deal done with them. And, you know, I had been tinkering with the idea of doing the podcast. So I said, you know what? I think that I'll be able to get more of the tapes out to the public in general if I just do this on my own, which is ultimately what I decided to do. And, you know, from there, I was able to put together a small team. Namely, my producer, Darren Wood, who has been unbelievable for me to work with. And, you know, we're just in lockstep in terms of creativity and kind of how we wanted the show to kind of come off, you know, because when we were trying to develop, you know, how should I do it? Because the Gacy case is old and it's been done so many times. And, you know, I was, you know, just dead set on not doing the same thing that's been done so many times. And, you know, there were a couple things. I had source material, which was unbelievable, but I didn't want to make Gacy the star, you know, that's been done. And he was just a deplorable human being. And despite the fact that my father was his attorney, I'm no fan, you know what I mean? So going into the podcast, my goal was to kind of make him definitely not the focal point, but, you know, kind of just in the background, where I was going to focus on, number one, the victims, because in the 43 years since this case has occurred, they're like an afterthought, which, and you, I know, as a massive victim advocate, I find that to be unconscionable. So going into it, really focusing on the victims, making people aware who they were as human beings, and, you know, trying to put a lot of focus on them was the number one thing that we wanted to try to accomplish with that. And I think that we did. And then, you know, I wanted to focus on how they got him a lot more than, you know, Gacy himself. I wanted to focus on the investigation. And when we dove in to that and we talked to basically everybody that was alive that was willing to talk to us. Now, there were a few people that were not willing to talk to us. And we realized why after the fact. And that's kind of like what you were talking about. Some of the things that we discovered as we were interviewing some of these old cops was just mind blowing. And, you know, I think that they were kind of the mindset, look, it's 43 years, the guy's long gone. He's dead. There's no bringing him back. So they really kind of started disclosing some unbelievably bombshell type like material. And I was blown away. Darren and I were both looking at each other when they started telling us, you know, what was going on and what happened back then. We were like, holy shit, man. So fast forward, we're actually just now, we just released part two of the 33rd episode. We had kind of come up with like an end. We're like, man, we have to end it. You know, it's like, as far as long form serial podcasts, maybe like the Murdaugh murders is the only one that I've heard that's gone this long. And Josh and True Crime Bullshit, you know, but he breaks it up into seasons, you know what I'm right. saying? So he's definitely gone as many, but he was smart and broke it up into multiple seasons, which in retrospect, I probably would have done. But, you know, being a neophyte podcaster, that was it was all new to us. So it was, you know, you live and you learn, man. But it's been an amazing experience. I love doing what we do. I love meeting the people such as yourself that I've been able to meet. And, you know, these are relationships that are just going to grow stronger throughout the years, man. So I, you know, I was really lucky. I originally met you, of course, at the True Crime Podcast Festival in KC last summer. Mm-hmm. And we were just starting, you know, and it just so happened that there happened to be an amazing bunch of folks at that particular event. And, you know, and COVID was, you know, kind of raging still. And, you know, to me, listeners being there didn't really matter as much as people in the industry that I really wanted to meet and start developing relationships with were there. And I just happened to run into like an awesome crew of humans. So
absolutely. As much as I love meeting listeners and hanging out with listeners, that particular conference, the amount of time we were able to spend with people like Josh and Nina and Generation Y and all of these people that,
amazing,
you know, that everybody looks up to in the podcast world, it was incredible. And now to call those people my friend is
awesome,
even,
right?
Even cooler. Yeah,
it's super cool, man. It was super cool. And like you've been doing it, man. You know, you've been in the shit, so to speak, for a minute here. You know, you've mm-hmm. been putting in the work. And by the way, I love your podcast.
Thank you.
You're another. I find you to have a very pleasing voice, which I hear occasionally about myself, but you give good voice, man. So I'm a big fan of your show, and I love what you do. And I know, you know, when we first met and you told me kind of what your inspiration was in terms of getting into this, it obviously kind of rocked me to my core. And, you know, I thought that was unbelievable, and I admire you. And I'm a big fan of what you do, on a day-to-day basis. So,
thank you, Bob.
You know, kudos to you, man.
Thank you. That's really, really nice of you. And to hear that from you, I'm a huge fan of you and the work that you do. And, you know, I'm one of those people, right? Just like probably most people that not really a big fan of defense attorneys. But when I met you and you explained to me, you know, the way you view the defense attorney role and probably the way it is supposed to be viewed, it right. made sense to me and changed my perspective. So I'm a little bit more forgiving, but I have to say, with what we're going to talk about, I might be a little bit harsh with that defense team.
And you know what? I think that's fair, you know, and I think that, you know, and that was kind of one of the things that we wanted to focus on mm-hmm. in the podcast as well, because there is a misconception in terms of, you know, the role of the defense attorney and what they bring to the table. And a lot of people feel the same way that you do about defense attorneys, you know, because a lot of times that, you know, the crimes that have been committed get, you know, kind of injected into the defense attorney themselves, where they're almost as viewed in the same light as the actual guy who may or may not have committed the crime, you know? So that's one of those things where I really kind of wanted to address in the podcast. I'm like, look, man, you know, this isn't like every defense attorney isn't some bottom feeder scumbag that's, you know, trying to get people off on loopholes. It's like, really what we do is, you know, and what both my wife and I, who's my partner and who's a tenacious defense attorney, you know, we police the police, you know, I mean, because the Constitution matters. And, you know, I mean, just the fact that every defendant has the right to a trial, no matter how, despicable their actions may have been, the bottom line is that the Constitution, which is an absolutely crucial part of our society, has to be defended. And, you know, and so what I kind of focus on in cases where, like, say, for instance, like the Red Wine case, you know, if I were handling that case and I'm looking at it, and we're going to get into it, but I mean, it's almost entirely circumstantial. You know, so it's one of those things where the first thing I look at is making sure that the police did their job properly, in terms of pretrial motions. And like, that's where a lot of the work for defense attorneys comes in that actually kind of give a shit about the Constitution, you know, like, because if we start letting the police kick our doors in without defense attorneys filing motions to suppress based on illegal searches, that creates a very, very slippery slope, which through time starts to affect us as normal citizens who are just out there trying to make a living and be good people. Yeah. And, you know, when that starts to slip on a massive scale, it's going to change the way that we live and everything that we know as Americans, you know, and there's some, you know, I mean, we're the land of the free, but you know, it's limited, you know, I mean, there's rules that have to be followed. So yeah, man, but I get it. You know what I mean? So
I think that's a good point though, because, you know, God forbid, an everyday normal citizen trying to do their best, trying to be the best version of themselves, trying to, you know, make a living and take care of their families. God forbid they get wrongfully accused of something.
Right.
Right. You're going to want a defense attorney to help you navigate that, because that's an impossible situation.
100%. And like, you know, so I'm doing my second season on a case that I actually handled, and you know, another just brutal case. And they absolutely, and it was in Omaha. And our client was Dr. Anthony Garcia, and he was accused of and convicted ultimately of murdering four people, including like a just sweet little 10-year-old boy. So like from and I have four kids, man, you know, it's like I'm not some kind of like, you know, but there's a job to do. And, you know, so I go into a case like that. And it's a death penalty case, because in Omaha, they have the death penalty. And, you know, I've always taken the position that, you know, if they're going to put somebody to death, without even getting into whether I'm pro death penalty or not, because that's a whole, we'd have to have a whole different segment on that. But, you know, in terms of that, I think it's absolutely crucial that when you go to trial on a case like that, you have to make damn sure that they prove their case beyond a reasonable doubt, because the end result of that case is that person's going to be executed. Yeah. So, you know, you can't have a defense attorney coming in half-assing it, you know, not when a life's at stake. And you know what, if they prove their case and the jury's like, yeah, you know, this is the guy, then justice has been done, you know? So, and I can go to bed feeling like, you know what, geez, man, you know, did I just let an innocent man, you know, go down on something? And like, I can go to sleep feeling like I've done my job. Mm-hmm. And I can look at myself in the mirror without worrying about, oh my God, you know, did I just fuck this guy's life up beyond all sure. recognition? You know what I mean? So, you know, it's a case by case situation, but yeah, man, it's one of those things where, you know, you got to do the work, and, you know, both sides of the process are incredibly crucial. And, you know, as important as the prosecutors are, the defense attorneys are equally as important, you know?
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I appreciate when you kind of talk me through that, because with my history, and we didn't even get to defense attorneys, right? I already have a problem with prosecutors in my own family. So, but it really did help change the way I viewed things. And I'm grateful that I had that in the back of my mind as I watched this trial, as I was streaming it through the summer and into the early fall on my YouTube channel. And so let's just get into the case now. So if you haven't listened to episodes 1 through 11, I would say go back and listen to them before you get into this part, because there's a lot of information, and I didn't even get to everything in those 11 episodes. I mean, there's so much in this case that I probably would have been like you, you know,
right.
Second part of episode 33. I wish I was smart enough like Josh to have, you know, broken this down further, but hey.
Yeah, but you know what? In your defense, man, you don't know until you dig in. You know what I mean? Because it was the same shit. There were, like, with the Gacy thing, I didn't dream in a million years mm-hmm. that it was going to be like I'd have so much material to cover that it would just keep going on and on and on and on. And that was with me keeping in mind I was trying to kind of edit it, and I wanted it to be interesting. I never wanted to get dry, you know? And like with the red wine case, man, it was like same thing as Gacy, 5-week trial. There was just a shit ton to cover. And then you were covering everything that predated it, which went on for years. You know what I mean? So it's a lot, man. So
it is a lot. And when really I cut that FOIA request fulfilled, I called my co-producer. I'm like, we are fucked.
I just got about 1,100 pieces of paper in the fucking mail, man, plus a bunch of digital shit. So,
I mean, hundreds of hours of audio and video footage.
It's unbelievable.
And initially going into this, I'm like, this is going to be a 4-episode miniseries in between seasons.
Yeah. Think again.
No. Yeah. No. I may end up at 14 episodes. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. So,
yeah, you know what? I mean, it's going to be as long as it has to be. You know what I mean?
Because
you got to tell the story, you know, and in the way that you do it, I mean, I've been loving it, man. You know,
Thank
I
you.
Really have. It's so well done. And it's so fluid. And I just love the way, you know, you mix your media, you know, you've got you hosting, and then you mix your clips in, and it's a beautifully done narrative, man, and it's super interesting, and it just hooks you in immediately. So again, congrats on that. You're killing it.
So for a quick recap, if you're not tired of hearing the recap, you can skip forward probably about 30 seconds if you're sick of it. So Dylan Redwine disappeared November 18th, 2012. He was on a court-ordered mandated trip to visit his father for the Thanksgiving holiday. He was very vocal to everybody around him that he had no interest in going. So much so that his mother reached out to her lawyer and requested if there was any way that she could get away from sending Dylan to Mark. Dylan disappeared the night that he arrived in Durango. He was never heard from again after a final text to a friend of his. And throughout the investigation, you know, there's so much that happened. You can go back and listen to it. I'm not going to bore you with all of those details again, but we're here finally at the trial now. And I just want to kind of get your initial impressions, because I did send you a bunch of stuff to look at, as well as encouraging you to review the episodes that I've already created. I don't expect that you've gotten through all of that, because I did overwhelm you, I think.
I got through a lot of it, man.
Oh, awesome.
I did. Awesome. You know, it's like I knew we were going to do this, and I'm not going to come on and, you know, disappoint. Like, I didn't want to do that. So I wanted to be prepared. So I did my homework, you know?
Okay. Awesome. Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
So what are your initial impressions, based on what you saw and what you reviewed?
So initially kind of going in, it was a tough case for both sides, you know, and when you sent me kind of the links, they had basically gotten a lot of the trial, you know, for me to be able to watch and listen. Mm-hmm. You know, I started with the openings to kind of see where both sides were going to go. And, you know, initially with a completely circumstantial case, because there really was no direct evidence. And, you know, I'm sure you know what the difference between direct and circumstantial is. I always explain to people, like, circumstantial evidence is a situation. So you go to bed, you look out your window, there's no snow on the ground. You go to sleep, you wake up, there's snow on the ground. You know that during the course of the evening that it snowed, even though you didn't see it happen. It happened. That is circumstantial evidence. So, and it can be equally as strong. Sometimes it can be stronger than direct evidence, because a lot of times direct evidence is witness testimony, and eyewitnesses can be incredibly unreliable sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so that was my first reaction, that you know, I was made aware that this was almost an entirely circumstantial case, and that's tough for the prosecutors in order to prove, because in a case like that, where you have prosecutors who are kind of having to put the pieces together, so to speak, with respect to how it went down, you know, they're creating a narrative, you know, and when they're creating that narrative, you know, they're taking all the pieces that they got from the evidence that was produced by law enforcement to them. And they're saying, okay, these are how the pieces fit, you know, and I thought that the prosecution did a very nice job, and what I, you know, even after the trial, I was like, damn, you know, that really could have gone either way. You know, I think ultimately, and I think the defense did a fine job, you know, in terms of like what you're going to the table with, as far as being a public defender on a case like that, you know, I think he ultimately ended up going with the only defense that he kind of could, which was not so much that the animals may have, you know, eaten Dylan, but that, you know, it was a reasonable doubt case, you know, because like when a defense attorney goes in, you're like, all right, like I got to look at the evidence. And if the evidence is strong, am I making an argument that they just can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, which is essentially what this guy did, you know, the defense attorney, you know, because it was like, if you were listening to the closing arguments, he's essentially saying, look, they just can't say definitively what happened. And I disagree with his assertion. And if you watch the rebuttal closing, which happens, because the way the closings go, the state goes first, then you have the defense attorney, and then the state gets the final word. So after the defense had gone, the state came and, you know, he got to do his rebuttal closing. He's like, look, everything that he said about like us not being able to say definitively what happened means that it's definitely reasonable doubt is wrong. That's correct. Like, that's not an accurate depiction of what reasonable doubt is. And there is no definition under the law of exactly what reasonable doubt is. It's basically, you got to use your common sense, and it's the highest standard in the law. So you've got like a preponderance of the evidence, which is kind of like if you're looking at like a football field, I always explain to people, like, preponderance of the evidence is like the 50-yard line. You just got to cross the 50 on a preponderance case, which is typically like civil stuff. When you do that, you're golden. In a criminal case, they have the highest burden, which is obviously beyond a reasonable doubt. And in that situation, it's crossing the goal line for the most part, you know, or at least getting like stopped right at the goal line. And it's basically like, it's got to be imparted onto the jury where this is probably the only way that it could have gone down, you know, which I thought that the state did a very nice job, you know, to be honest with you. And I thought with what, you know, particularly the defendant himself, he made that case really tough for the defense, because the guy is just a piece of shit. You know what I mean?
100%. Yeah. He definitely didn't do them any favors.
Oh my God, dude.
That guy. I think the only favor he did was not testifying.
And that's an absolutely, like, we could spend an hour talking about that. And like, kind of the way that you think about criminal cases, typically in terms of like what is in the complete and total control of the attorney, is everything strategically. So in terms of trial strategy, that's the lawyer. Like, my client can't dictate to me, look, this is the way I want to handle the case, because they're not an attorney and they don't understand how the law operates. So that's left within the purview of the lawyer. But there's three things that the defendant has an absolute constitutional right. And that's, do they want a jury or a bench trial? Do they want to testify? Okay. That's like the lawyer can't say, no, I'm not putting you on. If the defendant says I'm testifying and you can't stop me, they are testifying. And then, you know, the third thing is whether or not they want to plead guilty or not guilty. So those are the three things that are 100% in the control of the defendant. So, you know, that doesn't mean that as a lawyer, I'm always telling my clients, I'm like, look, you are not going to be able to help yourself on the stand, you know, depending on what the facts of the case are. You know, if you've got a case where the defense is basically requiring your client to testify, say it's a case where like it's a rape case or, you know, an aggravated sexual assault case, because they've done away with the word rape in terms of the criminal justice system. But, you know, in that type of situation where you're saying, well, there was consent, my client's going to have to testify, you know, mm-hmm. And I'm saying he has to come on. He can't say that it's consent and then not give his side of the story. So in that type of situation, you've got to put your guy on. In a case like this, there is no way in hell I would have let that guy get on the stand. I would have done everything in my power to convince him not to get on, because I'm like, dude, they have so much shit that they could just bury you for hours, for days. They would have just been grilling this guy, you know, about just what a shithead he was, you know, just like no one acts like that. Well, I shouldn't say no one, because he did, you know, in terms of your son goes missing, your 13-year-old boy, you've already are estranged from your two other boys. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this kid, he's basically your last hope in terms of your kids of trying to maintain a relationship. And this, just the way that the guy responded in every way, shape, and form just lends credence to the fact that either the guy's like just a fucking asshole, you know? And I mean, we know he's a shit eater, you know? I mean, he's a weird guy, you know? So, yeah. I mean, maybe he just is that kind of guy where he's a guy who works, you know, on pipes, man. You know, I mean, he's a blue collar guy, you know, and it's like the defense tried to make that point that he's a rough and tumble guy. And, you know, he can't be sitting there being emotional because, you know, all these guys who are coworkers with him are rough and tumble guys as well. You know? So like when the defense attorney was talking about him crying, you know, in his truck when he was at work, when he was looking at pictures of Dylan and stuff like that, prior to the whole, you know, Dylan being, you know, murdered, you know, it to try to kind of humanize him. And I didn't really find that very impactful, because everything that happened after the fact just outweighed it by, I don't know, a million pounds, you know?
Yeah. I mean, who goes to sleep at 11 o'clock at night when you report your kid missing at 6 p.m.? Who goes to sleep, turns off all their lights in the middle of the forest where there's no street lights? If you think your kid ran off and could potentially be coming back, would you not want your lights on?
Oh my God.
To guide them to your house?
Who would come home after you haven't heard from your kid all fucking day, living in the mountains, and then go take a nap when your kid's missing? Like, right. To me, that was so damning. I'm like, look, like I said, I've got four kids. If my kid was missing for 2 minutes, I'd be out of my fucking mind. 100%. You know what I mean? It's like if like I lose eye contact with my kid at like an amusement park, I'm like panicked, you know, like immediately.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah. Speaking of Chuck E. Cheese, like I remember having my kid there when he was like two. I lost sight of him for like 5 seconds. I was having a full blown meltdown. Like I was freaking out, digging in the ball pit, trying to find my kid.
Yeah, man.
You know, and then he's like standing there eating pizza.
That's the normal response. That's how a normal person acts when their kid is like potentially missing. So at this point, the boy, even if we're considering what his story is, you know, that, that Dylan got up early, that he went in, you know, he said, look, I'm going to come back at 11:30, and it's at 7:30 in the morning, and Dylan's like sleeping, and he's like, which, you know, look, I've got a 16-year-old, 13-year-old kids can be, you know, little jerk offs, you know, I mean, they're just, you know, they're raging hormones. They're just learning how to be a, like kind of a quasi adult, you know, so they can be a challenge, and, you know, and they're not necessarily wanting to hang out with their parents, you know, no matter what. Like that whole part of the state's case to me was kind of like, you know, because I've done enough divorce work to where I know how kids are, you know, and I've had four kids and, you know, they range from 27 to nine. So I've got the full gamut, you know, and I've gone through it all. And, you know, I know how kids are when they're teenagers. And, you know, the last thing they really want to do is hang out with their parents. And, you know, and you know, so you add in the factor of Dylan and Corey discovering these horrific pictures of their father doing some just super fetishy shit, man. You know, they're like, I mean, I've seen some fetish shit before, but that like kind of took
this was next
cake.
Level. Yeah,
it was. And it was next level.
And listen, I, you know, what people do in their bedrooms has nothing to do with me. I don't have an opinion one way or the other, but I can say, as a father of a teenage boy, that having that kind of image in front of you with no context, right? Like he had no context, nothing grounding him into any of that world at all.
Preparing him for it either, you know what I mean?
There's no preparation. Like, it was complete shock. And then that's your dad, right? That forever is going to change the way you see your father.
100%, man. You know, like just, I always say it on my podcast, but you can't unring a bell, you know, and that's a perfect example. It's like when he saw those images, he just must have been like, what in the fuck? You know, I mean, it's like it had to have been just, you know, and like, so, yeah, like extract, like just let's take, for example, let's take the pictures out of the game. All right. Mm-hmm. And kind of the way that you started the series, which I loved, is that you kind of focused on kind of what predated all this, and which was obviously the divorce and the custody battle, because it's key to what's going on. So take the pictures out of it and talk about a 13-year-old boy who they went through a protracted custody battle. And it was really a removal case where mom Elaine is saying, look, I'm not living up there anymore. I don't have anybody up there. I don't want to live up there. We're divorced. There's not shit up there. I have no support system up there.
My mom's dying.
And I have a compelling case. And of course the judge agreed, you know, cause those are tough cases where you're trying to take the kid away, you know, for like a great distance away from dad, you know? So you've really got to go in there with some strong evidence to convince a judge to say, okay, you know what? Yeah, I agree. You know, I think that you're going to have to work this out. You know, we'll make it up in summers, you know, but you're going to have less time, but it's in the best interest of Dylan, you know, and ultimately that's the way the judge went down with that. And, you know, so this creates a situation where Mark is just fucking raging, you know, like he is, and I've had these clients, you know, where they are just so angry. Dude, you know, I mean,
I've been there.
Real.
I've been there. I lived that. Yeah. That was my custody battle with my kids. So I related to that, you know. It was
right. It's devastating, you know.
It's
like
shitty situation. You can't win in that situation. Nobody's going to win.
No one's going to win, you know. And most importantly, like the kid's not going to win, you know, because what happens in that situation if you've got a parent that's not able to control their emotions, which is Mark, and you know, that's where you get all the shit talking happening, you know, where he's just talking shit about Elaine constantly, and that gets old, you know. And I always tell my clients when I was handling some divorce stuff back in the day, you know, I'd be like, look, you know, you need to understand, and I'd be telling this to my clients, I'm like, the judges don't give a shit about you or your wife or vice versa, whatever, like whoever I was handling. What they care about is the kids. And what you need to understand is that every time that you're sitting there talking shit to your child about the other parent, you need to understand that that parent's blood is coursing through their veins. You might as well just be talking shit about them as well. Yeah. Like that's lost on people a lot. And because they get caught up in the minutia and they get caught up in the fight, you know, which is an incredibly sad state of affairs, but it's such an emotional thing. You know, I mean, you can't get anything more emotional in terms of the criminal justice system than people fighting over the right to be with their kids, you know? So like emotions kind of win the day more often than not, more often than they should. And it's one of those things where you're like, well, you know, I wish that, you know, I could get through to this client. And it's just one of those things that it like, no matter, and I'm pretty persuasive, you know what I mean? I give it, the old college try to really convince them to say, look, man, be the bigger person here. Mm-hmm. You know, do this for your kid. Understand that it's not about you. It's about the kid. So in this situation, Mark was never capable of doing that. Like, he just could not do it. And so what builds up over time as, you know, and then you've got a boy who's turning into a teenage boy who's got his own shit going on, man. Kid's got his own fucking life. He's got girls. Yep. You know, you read from his personal texts. You know, he was a mature kid, like most of our kids are. You know, the internet, you know, basically killed innocence of children, you know.
Yeah.
Like our kids by the time they're 10 know more shit than I knew when I was 10 by like a million miles, you know. It's right. Like everything. Because you just can't watch them all the time. You know what I mean? Like, you just can't. As much as I put filters on and everything else, it's like you can't control them when they're at friends' houses or on phones. It's just, it's impossible. So, you know, just the dissemination of information that we weren't necessarily privy to at that same age is now available to them. So they're maturing faster, and they're, you know, kind of that arc in terms of like when you expect, you know, kids to be doing certain things and acting certain ways as they grow has, you know, gotten younger and younger and younger. So you've got a 13-year-old kid who doesn't want to fucking hang out with his dad, you know? So it's like, as much as I buy into the concept that, like, and that was going to be the one thing I was going to tell you. Like, I don't think that the shit picks are really what drove Mark to do what he did. No. I think it was this concept that he was losing this kid to that woman is what drove him to do it, you know, to be honest with you. And you know, and it was like,
I think there was a combination of things. I agree with you. I don't think it was the primary thing that sent Mark over the edge, but I think, to your point, that Dylan was pushing his boundaries, and he was pushing as hard as he possibly could against his dad, who's trying to, like you said, really cling on to him, to this idea of Dylan, not even who Dylan really was, because I don't think he knew Dylan. So
not
I think
anymore. Not yeah anymore, I agree.
I think he had this romanticized idea of his kid in his mind, and that he was somewhat playing the victim, and maybe a lot playing the victim in this whole situation. You know, my evil bitch ex-wife is ruining my life and getting in between me and my kid. And I think, you know, and this is all speculation, and I hate speculating, but this is just kind of, after looking at all this, where my brain kind of landed with this thing, is I think that he had this romantic idea of Dylan. Mm-hmm. Dylan shows up, and he's been building up this anticipation for this visit. He had just lost that custody battle, so he's already salty.
Salty.
And Dylan is mouthing off the entire time and was poking him. You know, he knows his dad. He knows how to poke him to get him angry.
And he's got the pictures in his back pocket. Like, he knows that exists.
And he's going to bring those out. Yeah. Right. And so I think the buildup of all of that, and they were probably fighting. And I believe, and based on everything, that Mark raged out. He raged out and lost control and may have even blacked out, you know, emotional blackout. Right.
That's 100% possible, man.
And then it was too late.
Totally, dude. This was not some premeditated shit, like where he knew that he was killing his kid when he came in. I agree 100%. I think it was one of those situations where he just lost his shit, you know, and it might have been a thing where he just threw across the room and he fucking smashed his head on the coffee table and, you know, like, oh my God, I just killed my kid. You know what I mean? Like that type of thing where, you know, like this is, there's no part of me that thinks that he's like, okay, well, you know, my kid's coming up. I'm not letting her win. You know, I'm going to kill him. You know, I don't think it was that. I think it's exactly what you said. I think it was just something that was building up. And, you know, Dylan knew, like you said, knew how to poke the bear, and he poked the bear. And, you know, they got into a physical altercation. You know, Mark was 3 times the size of the kid and, you know, probably threw him around like a rag doll, and the kid smashed his head. Boom. And that's it, you know, and never regains consciousness. And this guy's like, oh, my fucking God, you know, like. But the thing that like just stuns me is, even if that's how it goes down, is like the difficulty in kind of like how you play that. Like if I'm Mark Redwine, how do I play that as the days progress? Say that it's exactly how it goes down. You know, yeah. I'd be so overwrought with emotion, like just like I wouldn't be able to function as a human, you know, if I had done that to my kid, you know, let alone disposing of the body. Forget all about it. Just I'm talking about just the brutality that you've like literally just ended your own child's life. Like I'd be like just a sobbing mat. Now, granted, I'm an emotional guy. You know, same. I mean, I'm very same. Prone to crying. I'll cry like I cry at movies and shit. You know, and I'm not afraid of it. I don't care. You know, it's like I'm an emotional person. And
I can't watch America's Got Talent without crying. Oh. So I'm with you.
Yeah, I mean, dude, I'm easy, man. So, you know, for me, you know, personally, kind of looking at that, I'm like, God, the guy was just so off-putting. Like always, mm-hmm. Like from the inception, when, you know, the cops are there and CBI's there and they're trying to talk to him. And, you know, he's sitting on the fucking deck the day after, like having a cup of coffee while CBI and you know, search and rescue are out there looking for his kid. And he doesn't say shit. It's like, I don't know. From a defense attorney's perspective, like if that case landed on my desk, I'd be, man, it'd be tough. You know, I'd be telling this guy like, and that's the thing. Like, I don't ask my clients if they did it. You know what I mean? That's like, cause like people are always like, how do you fucking defend these people? And I'm like, well, you know, as part of my role, I have to try to check my morality at the door, because if I don't do that, then it becomes extremely difficult for me to be able to function in terms of what I have to do, which I have an ethical duty to do pursuant to my profession. And, you know, so I say, okay, I'm not going to ask this guy, you know, in a situation like that, you know, did you do it? You know, it's not like the movies, you know, I'm your lawyer. You have to tell me, did you do it? Did you didn't do it? You know, he's maintaining that he didn't do it. I'm not trying to grill out of him whether or not he did. But I'm going through the evidence with him and I'm saying, look, man, this is where we have some major problems. Okay. You've got like your behavior and the way that you've acted in the last, and you know, shit, by the time I went to trial, man, we're talking, it's what, 6 years,
5 years,
5 years. Yeah. You know? So, I mean, they had like a world of shit about how this guy was acting, you know, like, forget about the Dr. Phil stuff. I mean, that's like, you know, I mean, which was insane.
That's just like a sideshow.
Yeah, totally. It was a total clown show. You know, it's like when you're looking at like the real stuff, you know, because that's just him trying to make, you know, get ratings and like, oh, take a, you know, a lie detector. You know, it's like,
look at me in the eyes.
Yeah. So
come on, give me a break.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's just like that particular guy just trying to kind of like reconcile how he was acting. Mm-hmm. It's just really, really hard to do, you know? And it's like when you have 12 normal human beings sitting on a jury that have kids and they're looking at this guy's response and how he was acting, that's just, it speaks volumes, you know?
And he goes like on that, one search.
And it was half that. It was like, he went out with Corey and within like, you know, 20 minutes, he's like, I'm fucking tired. Let's go. Yep. He's not here. And Corey's like, what the fuck? He's like, that's when he knew. He's like, at that point, I knew that my dad did it. You know, it's like no one whose kid was missing and was like, didn't actually kill them would act like that. Like it was so off-putting, like ever. That's just not what normal people do. So, you know, it's one of those things where I don't know, man, it's a tough case.
So I felt really bad for the defense team. Because I know they had their work cut out for them. Like I get it, but I can say like, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe I misinterpreted this, but as I'm watching the trial unfold, I'm noticing that Moran, who was like the lead defense attorney until he had his domestic violence situation, and then Bogan became the lead attorney there. But Moran and even Bogan to a certain extent seemed extremely unprepared, in my opinion, throughout the trial. And I don't know if that's a fair statement. You agree? Okay.
No, I do agree. You know, and I don't know how much of the fact that he kind of was injected into, you know, kind of the lead counsel Like you said, because of what happened with you know, the original guy. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily excuse him. You know, I mean, it's like, like even in the closing argument, I mean, that wasn't, it just wasn't the kind of closing where you're like, I didn't feel like he had a handle on, because he spent the first hour and a half just basically kind of shitting on their theory, as opposed to saying, this is what the lack of evidence is, and that lack of evidence should bring you to this point, instead of just saying, you know, like it's a what if case, and what if means not, you know, they didn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. That's not how it works. You know what I mean? In that type of case where you've got, like, if I were handling that case, you know, and when we get into that Garcia thing that I'm going to do next, I mean, and they fucking hated us, man. Like I fully expect to finally get some shitty reviews, not because of the podcast not being good, because they fucking hate me. You know, but I'm going to try to explain to them, you know, I had a job to do. It was a death penalty case, but you know, we fought everything on that, but we did it within, you know, the bounds of reason. And it came off because they disliked us so much that, you know, they thought that we were sleazeballs. And I'm like, man, no. I mean, the state was the sleazeballs on this. And like, I, you know, as I sit here today, I have no idea whether or not my client, like, we had put together such a good defense in that case that I had convinced myself that he was innocent. You know what I mean? It's like, and it was scientific based. It wasn't, this wasn't like my gut, you know, and with the red wine case, you've got pretty weak DNA, you know, I mean the DNA in terms of, you know, in this concept that he, you know, basically decapitated the body, like that should never have like been a concept. So it's like, that's way too much blood. Like the cleanup, like I thought the state made a huge mistake on that. Like if I'm the state, I'm going with like, they, you know, they wrestled, you know, he threw him.
He admitted to that.
He so had like, him there.
Go
he
on
had
that. Him there.
Exactly. Yeah. Just run with that.
Yeah,
you know, and it got out of hand, and Dylan was like, you know, he was a smaller kid. He wasn't like a, you know, and Mark was a big, heavy beer drinking motherfucker, you know, and he took his kid, threw him around like a rag doll. The kid hit his head on a hard surface and it killed him. You know, I mean, to me, if I'm the state, that's the easier route to go than to come up with this. Like there's a massive amount of blood that would have been required to be cleaned up, and he only had 14 hours to do it. It's like, that's just like, I think they made way, way more work for themselves.
They're almost creating more doubt for themselves.
They are. They totally do. Yeah. Because it's like, you know, and that was the only thing that the defense could do in terms of trying to pick apart, because the DNA was weak. You know, it really was. And like you've got, and kind of when you get into that side of, you know, the criminal justice system, like from the defense side of it, I have to deal with DNA experts because it's now ingrained in the criminal justice system, which thank God for that. I mean, it's like leaps and bounds, but you know, it's like, oh man, dude, it's insane. But you know,
some of these experts that they brought up were
just whacks, man. Just whack total whack jobs.
Yeah.
You know, and like, you're going to get that out there because, you know, DNA, like I had this expert in the Garcia case that was unbelievable. He actually, I used him, and he was brilliant because he could break down DNA so that layman can understand it, which, you know, when you're talking about a jury and you're talking about, oh, dude, it's huge. Because when you're putting experts on, the jurors' eyes just glaze over. They're like, I have no fucking idea what this guy's talking about. Mm-hmm. And he's boring the shit out of me. And he's been on the stand for 5 hours between direct and cross. And I quit listening about 4.5 hours ago. You know, like that's the reality of like expert witnesses in these types of cases. It's always like they basically cancel each other out. That's not what people in terms of a jury are relying on when they're, you know, rendering a verdict. They're going on their common sense. They're going on the things like how Mark acted. That's not how a person who didn't do this acts.
Right.
You know, he acted like he was guilty. You know, everything that he did, everything that he said for the years that followed were just indicative of that this guy did it, you know? So that's ultimately what the jury hung their hat on. I have no doubt about it. Yeah. If we could poll the jury and call them, I'm sure that they'll like, I'd be shocked if they said it was anything other than that, you know, because like, you know, the cadaver dogs, I don't know. It's like it's like some states don't allow dog sniffs in, some do.
Well, and then just like the varying degrees of certifications with the varying bodies that certify with different, like, different expectations, different requirements. So how can you hold anything to that?
Exactly.
When there's no consistency across the board, like,
exactly. It's like, and that's why some states, like, anytime you're trying to get scientific evidence in, and like, and I kind of go through it like earlier in the pod, like when DNA started becoming a thing, and you know, it's got to pass muster scientifically in order for a court to accept it as not junk science, you know? So when DNA started first evolving to the point where we're saying, well, holy shit, man, we're able to kind of like identify who people are through these strands and, you know, the loci and all that stuff. And it's like the courts didn't understand it, you know? So in order for that to start being accepted as evidence that was reliable to the extent where, okay, we find this to be reliable enough to be heard by a jury in order for them to take it in and use it in their ability to be able to come up with a verdict, you know, it's a long road to hoe. And you know, with things like dog sniffs, you know, and that's why like lie detectors are just not allowed. And like you kill, like, yeah. I don't know if there's any state in the union that allows lie box to come in, because it's just not. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's some, I think it's a useful tool, you know, not necessarily from the results, but to kind of just see how the person's reacting during the actual examination, right, as opposed to what the result is. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's more of an investigatory tool to understand the mindset of the person that's being accused. 100%. Right?
100%.
Yeah. Although,
and plus, just asking them to take it and whether they agree or they don't agree,
it's a big
is
sign.
A huge indicator, right?
Yeah. Huge sign. Yeah. Actually, we'll be right back next week, I guess. Thanks for listening and stay safe, New Mexico.
Thanks for having me.